Blog Talk Radio.
Hello? Hello?
Hello, Stid. You're on.
Oh. Can you hear me? Yeah, can you hear me?
I hear you.
Okay. Cool.
Hits.
Is Mike on yet? Hello?
No, but you're broadcast. Stead?
Yes, I'm right here. Can you hear me? Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah, you're broadcasting.
Okay.
This show's
all right. Well, that was odd. hello, good evening, everyone. Hopefully we'll get Mike on shortly. Welcome to another episode of the Two Guys Soccer Podcast. I am Stead, and forever joined by Mike, who hopefully will be on shortly. And we're going to have a relatively active show this week. We're going to bring on a couple of guests to discuss the recent goings-on of the U.S. soccer team, as well as to discuss what's been going on in England lately, and to talk about, of course, the upcoming match with two teams that are definitely trending in direct opposite directions in the Premier League, where with Manchester United playing Liverpool in probably the marquee game of the weekend for the Premier League. So, first of all, let's go ahead and give a shout out to our sponsor, Flanagan's Harp and Fiddle at 4844 Cordell Avenue in Bethesda, Maryland, the Montgomery County and the DMV's premier location for sports and live music. It's also a great place to catch up on not only the Premier League and the Scottish Premiership, but also, if you are interested, great place to catch the Rugby World Cup. They will be airing matches that are on the upcoming slate, as we are at the point now where the Rugby World Cup is in the quarterfinals. So I think if you wanted to actually go and have a really great time, if you can get over there, England is playing Australia Saturday morning at 3:15 a.m., followed by New Zealand playing Ireland at 6:15 a.m. So I'm sure you can guess what that's going to be like when the at a pub called Flanagan's Harp and Fiddle, what that type of environment is going to be for a rugby match. So also, while we're on the topic of the Rugby World Cup, I just want to give a special shout out to the citizens of Japan. Japan is a country that I hold very dear to my heart, having lived over there for a number of years, as well as visited there on multiple occasions. And currently my parents live there. So I hope everything turns out okay with the worst typhoon that they've had in the past 6 years. And having lived over there through countless numbers of typhoons, I can definitely say that they are relatively easygoing for the Japanese, as they're so used to it. But of course, as any place that has that type of environment, disasters do happen. So thoughts and prayers go to the people in Japan, and also the participants of the Rugby World Cup. It's great to see, I believe it was the Canadian national team for the Rugby World Cup was actually taking their off day to assist in cleanup and some of the search and rescue operations that were going on in Japan. So all the best to the Japanese, and kudos to you, Canada. So let's see where to begin this week. Well, I'd definitely like to talk about the upcoming U.S. game against Canada, but I'm going to hold off getting too in-depth until we bring our guests on, of course. But the U.S. recently played a UEFA Nations League game against Cuba, and that game was on Friday evening. And to say that game was not the most compelling game would be putting it lightly. The score line was 7-0, and thank you to the United States for taking their foot off the gas a little bit, because it was really, really comical to watch. Cuba is not a country that has a deep-rooted history in soccer. Of course, I'm not going to say anything negative about Cuban athletes, because they have been stalwarts of great athletic performance in this part of the world. I can speak about their pursuits in baseball, as we all very well know, but also in track and field, as well as boxing and amateur wrestling. And even now we're seeing great fighters in MMA who are coming from Cuba. So their athletic talents are, of course, nothing that any sports fan is unfamiliar with. But that does not mean that they have actually been able to compete in any sort of level in the world football game. It was a game that was not for anyone who considered themselves a purist. The Cuban team was really unable to play any significant defense. They were leaving the American wing players wide open. Defensive players were tracking back, unable to pick up any player who was trailing from the U.S. side, and they were getting lots of easy tap-ins for goals in the first 20 minutes of the game. I mean, the first goal happened in about 32 seconds for Weston McKennie. Weston McKennie had a fantastic game with a hat trick before 25% of the game was even over. 13th minute, Weston McKennie has a hat trick. And that put the score at 4-0, because the person who assisted his first two goals, Jordan Morris, also got in the action with a goal in the 9th minute. So you saw at the end of the first half, score was 6-0. And sorry, I stopped watching that game at 4-0. I said, that's enough. I'm going to go jump on the trampoline outside with my son, as opposed to watching this complete butt kicking that Cuba was taking. I think the only positive of this game for the United States is that you had a situation where they were able to do some practice with the system that they were incorporating under Greg Berhalter. They were able to do a lot more possession play. They were able to work the ball out the back, even though the ball wasn't in the back too often. And they were able to work on various tactics that are hopefully going to serve them well as they play against better competition. I think the biggest indictment of this whole thing is basically the Nations League set up for CONCACAF. The whole thing was just not really, really, I don't want to say worth it. I do see the positives of the Nations League, especially for smaller clubs and smaller countries, to hopefully give them some more games to play. I find it odd that Cuba was in the A bracket. I think that that's probably not the best place for them to be, especially when you look at some of the teams that are in the B bracket that I would suspect have more of a footballing history than Cuba, mainly Jamaica. So, but I think Nations League also lets you see the real disparity of resources and just size of country for CONCACAF. There are, 40 some odd nations. I could be wrong. I'm not sure of the exact number. I think it's 40, 41 in CONCACAF. And really, outside of the United States and Mexico, and of course, Honduras, maybe sometimes Nicaragua, maybe El Salvador, Jamaica, and Trinidad and Tobago, you really don't see countries that are even just large enough to even field this consistent national team of professional players. We can go through the list, and I'm looking at Anguilla, Antigua and Barbuda, Aruba, Bahamas, Barbados. These nations don't have more than a few hundred thousand people, even their whole population. And we all know that also a very, very big sport in the Caribbean is cricket and also track and field. So a lot of these countries aren't looking at soccer as their kind of their number one place to play. So to discuss the A group, we have Bermuda, Canada, Costa Rica, Cuba, Curacao, Haiti, Honduras, Martinique, Mexico, Panama, Trinidad and Tobago, and the United States. Now, one could say that if some of these countries had better resources, they would be much more inclined to compete for CONCACAF glory. I'm speaking about Haiti in particular, because Haiti has a very large population with very, 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 very talented athletes who have shown their prowess by playing often in other countries, mainly United States, Canada, and even France to some extent. And they qualified for the World Cup before. Granted, it was over 40 years ago, but they have qualified for a World Cup. So it's good for these smaller nations to just get more games and play more. I believe Mike was discussing that before. So, but at least it's something. I think, though, from the perspective of the United States, it may not be the best route. Michael Bradley, after their game against Cuba, was, relatively critical of the Nations League, and I can't say I blame him. And I just want to quote him really quickly. He said he's not a huge fan at all, and you want to play as many days as possible against the best teams, against the biggest teams. And the reality for us is playing games in CONCACAF, they don't do enough to prepare us for the type of games that you see at the World Cup. I've talked about this in a lot of other moments where the formula for qualifying and the types of games you play in qualifying is so different than the formula to do well at the World Cup or types of games you play at the World Cup. That's our reality. There's no use complaining about it because it is what it is. If you just ask me how I feel about added mandatory games like this. So I can't disagree with Michael Bradley from a United States perspective. Playing against Cuba, playing against, Martinique, playing against, I don't want to throw Canada in there because they're playing them next, but playing against Bermuda probably isn't the best way to prepare for the level of competition that they're going to see when they play, if they qualify for the World Cup. I have to say if they qualify for the World Cup now, and before I could just say when they qualify, due to the debacle that occurred before the 2018 Cup. But that's neither here nor there. So I will say, though, that at the point where the U.S. is right now, where they're in a serious rebuilding phase, playing against some teams that may not stack up to them as far as competition is concerned might not necessarily be a bad thing. They may be a bit better prepared in the long run with the additional practice in game situations. So, that's kind of my stake with CONCACAF, but let's see. I think I'm going to try and bring in one of our guests a little early today since we're unable to get Mike on at the moment. Hope he is trying to figure out his tech situation right now. So we'll see if we can bring on a guest a little early so we can have some back and forth so you don't have to listen to me ramble on about U.S. soccer the whole time. I know I've done a couple of solo shows, but it's always better when there's someone else here. So let's see. Next for the United States is a game against Canada. Now, Canada's men's soccer team is one of those teams that I think would benefit greatly from having some more games. They are, I'm not going to say that they are a soccer country. They seem to be more of a of course a hockey nation, but Canada also has a very rich history in track and field. And also, we seem to forget, though, even though it is a quite regional game, American football, or gridiron football, is actually quite popular in Canada. And their league, I think if you had a national team for American football or gridiron football, of course, number one would be the grand old US of A. But I would say number two would be Canada. And possibly number three would be Samoa, because for some reason, if you are a Samoan and you come to the United States to play football, you go pro. That's how great those guys are at good old gridiron football. But you know, Canada, you know, just looking at their history, they have, I don't believe they've ever actually qualified for a World Cup beyond, oh no, they did qualify once, excuse me, in 1986, they qualified, and they finished 24th out of 24 teams. They scored 0 goals and had 5 goals scored against them. So that's not necessarily their best place. Now, they do have a couple of CONCACAF Gold Cups. Now, the CONCACAF Gold Cup, though, is one of the most awkward and really not exciting international regional competitions in the world. I would say it ranks possibly dead last after the Asian Federation as far as the drama of that tournament. So, saying they have a couple of championships there is really not, I don't think that's really saying much, especially if I would say the CONCACAF Gold Cup has changed significantly in the past 10 years, but probably not so much since they won in 2000. And so I think we have a guest on, so I'm going to go and bring him on. Matt, you on?
Yeah, I'm on, man.
Hey, how you doing, Matt?
Good, man. Sorry, I was just a little late. My bad on that.
Yeah, we were we're unable to get Mike on at the moment, so I was up here just kind of talking by myself. So I was like, well, let me just see if I can bring Matt on now so we can dig in a bit, because I'd love to hear your thoughts on I'm not sure if you heard, but the schlacking that, you know, the way the U.S. boat raced Cuba, especially in that first half recently, and how kind of like, are these Nations League games really worthwhile for U.S. soccer at this particular moment in their history? So did you happen to catch the game or catch any of the highlights of it?
I caught some of the highlights. We talked about it last week. I kind of laugh at it. Like, they're trying to make, you know, just kind of Nations League for CONCACAF, and it's just, it's already spread so thin as it is. And I think you said last week as well, like, I just, at least for the U.S. for competitions, you kind of drew a comparison between kind of Australia, how they recognize, like, Oceania is just, like, wasn't a good conference for them. And they just straight up went to Asia and, realized that was better. And I just think that eventually, I think that's kind of the path that U.S. is going to have to go down. U.S. and probably Mexico as well. It's just until it's obviously monetarily, I guess, attractive to them, they'll always stick to CONCACAF because they'll think it's the easiest way for them to get to the World Cup. But it's just not for developing our nation. It's just not I just don't think these are good. I mean, I was going to text you too during the shellacking. Was just like, isn't this great that we didn't call up any of the young players to, like, that we were talking about earlier?
Right.
I'd have much rather, I know this sounds ridiculous, but I'd much rather us win like 2-0 with a whole bunch of kids with the average age is like 22 to 24 and get them some experience. And just, I mean, Cuba's never been really good ever.
Yeah.
Also, I mean, and I don't mean to be, I hope this doesn't sound offensive or anything like that, but I mean, there's a lot of times when the Gold Cup happens, they have a huge history of, like, their players kind of defecting when they come to the States, and then, like, two, three, four of their players will just, hop off the plane and just go missing. And it's just, these are the kind of, I mean, it's not, obviously that's an extreme example, but, when we're playing against small island nations, and I think, again, exactly what you were saying last week, comparing it to, like, the Oceania, Australia is playing against, Tonga and, New Zealand, or, like, their biggest rivals. And it's just, is this really helping their development as a nation for soccer? Like, I just don't think it is. And so unless FIFA, the only way I would see that, like, U.S. switching is if FIFA kind of recognized, like, okay, CONCACAF is just not, like, they come to the World Cup, and Mexico is the only team that is, you know, progressing at all past the group stages. So we're going to like limit you to one space, like one spot. And then the other spot has to do a playoff for the, like with the fifth ranked, you know, South American team.
Right.
And I'm sure that's like, that would turn some heads and change some decisions, but it's just, it's really frustrating to watch because you're like, cool, we won 7-0, but the team is not really that good. And it just makes us kind of scratch our head of like not really knowing how good we actually are. So,
absolutely agreed. I'm glad you brought up the part about players defecting, because that is a real thing. It's a real thing.
Yeah.
And I think it just shows you how good they are at a lot of other sports, because that does continue to happen. Yet they're still able to compete significantly in sports. I was bringing up earlier, like wrestling and track and field. And I know like women's volleyball, they're really good. And baseball.
Yep.
So, you know, they have a machine of athletics down there, but it's just, of course, the instability of the nation is making it where players are going, well, I can have a run at this and hopefully try to make some money. I can send them to my family. And it's really not, it's very difficult for the Confederation to actually field a consistent team, because of course I could also see them going, well, we don't want to bring our best players because, as you said, they may get in a van in the hotel and then we're looking for them the next morning and they're gone.
Imagine that. You're a professional athlete. Like, you're literally one of the best in your country, and you're willing to, like, literally give all of that up. Like, I mean, some of these players, they never play soccer. I mean, I know some of them have, but, like, some of these people, like, they'll go and, like, they're just, like, you know, go and work, you know, like manual labor jobs just because it's that bad for them and their family, you know.
Right.
At least they feel that way. I mean, it's a crazy sacrifice. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. It is. It's sad though, because you know, they're still trying. Of course they're going to try and compete. Of course they are. They're a nation of proud athletes. They're going to try and compete. And and then the flip side though is exactly what you were saying. Because I think that's going to happen. I really do. Because you're going, even with the World Cup expanding to 48 teams, that is for the benefit of you. And that is for the benefit of Europe, CONMEBOL, and Africa, well before it's to the benefit of CONCACAF. Because I think CONCACAF is like, they were probably tied with the Asian Federation, but now I think they're going to be passed. I mean, South Korea is good, and they're consistently good. Japan is, I mean, they're a strong squad. So, we'll see that. And I think if something like that was to occur, I see Mexico running at top speed to join CONMEBOL before they stick around in a confederation like that, where you got one team and you have to play. Because then, of course, that's going to bring down their ability to really develop on an international side. Because Mexico is one of the best countries to never final in a World Cup. They are. So.
Yeah, I agree with that. Honestly, I'm going to be honest with you. I think, you know, projection-wise and future-wise, I think that Asia is probably level with CONCACAF right now, and it's going to quickly surpass. Like, I mean, it's kind of always a joke when you're growing up, you know, like playing with China, like, the one-star team in FIFA, but, like, there's a billion people there. They're going to figure it out.
They're going to figure it out, right.
They have so many billionaires there already investing in clubs.
Yep.
The sport's gonna come. Like, they're going to be better eventually. They already have Australia in that region, who's decent. Japan is good. South Korea, like you said, are good. It's just a matter of time, like, until that whole area just really starts to excel.
Even a country like I can see a country like Indonesia. All of a sudden, they have a little league, and they are paying clubs money, significant money, to come and play there for their international audience. You're seeing Manchester United and Arsenal; they're all going there to play. Real Madrid's going there to play exhibition games. They're playing in Singapore. You know, the game is going to grow over there, and they have the population to support an additional an additional game that's very popular. They can do it. So you're going to see growth occurring throughout the world. That's not. It's just the ability for them to grow in this part of the world just doesn't exist because of the way just the way the borders are drawn. I mean, the United States is just so big.
Absolutely. I completely agree. And that's the thing too. We last few times have been on and we've talked about development. That development takes time. What U.S. was in 1994 is, probably, what China is now, even China's maybe a little worse, but still, it's going to come. It's eventually going to get there.
Yep.
They have so much money coming in for it. It's going to become too big to fail.
And they got a couple players already in England. They're starting to send players over.
Yep.
It's the wave is going to start. It's definitely going to start.
It is.
Yeah. Yeah,
absolutely.
And you see, Japanese players have been playing in Germany for a very long time. And the thing about the Japanese players is their top players start consistently for Premier League teams and in Italian teams and for German teams and for French teams. You don't see the U.S. doing that anymore. You just don't see it.
No.
And I remember I was living in Japan when the J-League started. I remember when that league started. And the way they were packing those stadiums is something that the MLS has never seen outside of Atlanta. They've just never seen that. And it was right off the bat. So I'm not surprised that that they're slowly kind of coming up and they're becoming a more dominant side internationally. And the United States is going to start to play catch up. I could even see FIFA eliminating CONCACAF completely and having an America's kind of bracket. So basically everybody on this part of the world is like, you know what? You guys are all one. You got 12 entries. That's what you have. You got 12
You're
entries to the World Cup. Yeah. And that's what you get. You get 1/4 of them and then good luck. And you know that 10 of them are going to come from South America. Cause I think the top 8 teams in South America would easily place in CONCACAF. They would easily finish third. The top 8 teams there, I think they would.
No problem. Yeah, no, and honestly, too, I've gotten sucked into it the last 7 years because, my wife's family's from Bolivia, and when we watched the qualification, Bolivia's terrible, but don't get me wrong. That qualification process, it is so brutal. Argentina went. This is I think 10 years ago, Argentina went to La Paz, Bolivia, and that's way higher than Mile High Stadium. Okay.
Yeah, it's 10,000 feet
and
above
Argentina,
sea level.
With Messi, lost 5-0 to Bolivia, and it's all about who can win 2 away games in CONMEBOL, and that's the best team. You'll have Brazil, they'll lose to Paraguay in Paraguay. It's so competitive and it's so fun to actually watch because even the bad teams have a chance going into it. We're probably terrible, but if we can just string a whole bunch of home wins together and scrap a tie and maybe one win against, one of those, a Colombia or Ecuador, we have a shot here. Peru has made it a couple of times now.
It's exciting.
I think Peru knocked Chile out.
I think if I remember correctly, they knocked Chile out, who was the defending Copa America champions.
They're back to back. It's just awesome. We get so focused on European, and then obviously it's here, it's CONCACAF. It's just we really forget just how good all the good South American players that come there. When it comes to the World Cup, we think, Brazil, that's right, or Argentina, that's right. And it's the whole qualifying process. It's all of those players are playing all the time, and it's just really exciting. And me too. I'm gonna be honest. I get excited talking about it because I would love the U.S. to be a part of that.
I would too.
It would be so amazing. Like,
yeah, I would too.
You would be, you know, playing against, like, are you going to tell me, like, playing against, you know, Messi's and Neymar's and, like, would
yep.
it improve our youth players? Like,
yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah,
would.
If you knew
yeah.
you had to face James Rodriguez twice before just to get to the World Cup, I think your development strategy might be a little different. Absolutely. What I would hate to see is if that was a possibility and Mexico was to, like, try to play in a different confederation where U.S. tries to just go, okay, well, at least you know we're always going to qualify and just try to, like, stack
yeah.
dollars on World Cup money, which would be such a U.S. thing to do. But if that was the case, then they know they're going to be a group stage
yeah.
exit every single time, and it's not even going to be exciting.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just going to be – and you're going to see an even worse situation when you go to a U.S. game where if they play anywhere outside of the West Coast, they could hopefully get a home game. Because they play on the West Coast,
oh
it's basically
God.
The you know don't play Mexico in LA. It's a home game for Mexico, so it'll
oh,
be.
Yeah,
I think it'll
Texas
be it'll
or,
be even worse. Yeah, yeah, Texas. Yeah, it'll
yeah.
be even worse if that's the situation
yeah.
where they're
well,
like, oh,
the
it's not all these
you'll
home
see,
games.
You'll see the stadiums being empty, man, and it's like that
yeah.
looks terrible. Like,
right.
you know, it's like I'd actually rather have you know Mexican fans fill the stadiums, you know, because at least that money will technically go back somewhat to USSF, but like. I mean, it's like, and honestly, too, if we actually switch to, if we switch to CONMEBOL, like, even our coaching would improve. Like coaches from, it's funny, if you look at, like, more than half the coaches, I think it's two-thirds of the coaches of CONMEBOL are Argentinian. Like, they're, you know, their coaches are, like, it spreads throughout. Like, all
right.
of them kind of share coaches. Whoever has waves, you know, of coaches, they all start to benefit from it because,
mm-hmm.
you know, these countries are looking, you know, these people are former players are, like, looking for jobs and trying to
right.
develop. And I think
right.
what happened here. It's like, you know, even actually you brought up Japan, and actually one of Japan's big development keys was that they brought a bunch of Brazilians over. Like, Zico was their head coach for a long
yep.
time. And, like,
yep.
they had a player named Alex who was born in Brazil, but, like,
born in Brazil.
Been in Japan
yep.
for so long. Yeah.
Yep.
Like,
yeah. And even Marcus Tulio Tanaka. I mean, he was Brazilian.
yeah, exactly. I mean, it's like, you know, could we get that? It's like, is that possible? You know, we're already bringing players from Germany over. Might as well bring some other people as well. So, I don't know. It'll be interesting to see
yeah.
moving forward. So
cool. Well, let me see if we can bring on Will so we can maybe shift gears a little bit. That was a great conversation.
Yeah.
That was great.
Yeah.
I wasn't planning on going that way, but that was a really compelling look at what can happen if you know, if this doesn't go well. And if we're seeing this
yeah.
continued development and seeing this continue with U.S. soccer, because they seem to be floating. I mean, the FIFA rankings are the biggest sham ever. And they seem to be floating in that kind of like no man's land where they're just not sure
mm-hmm.
what they are. Or are they going to really develop, or are they going to stay as just a team
yeah.
that qualifies? And if they do happen to get out of the group stage through a fluke because the ball goes through England's goalkeeper's leg, and you're able to qualify. And then, you know, you have
yeah.
to have a game of 16 saves by your goalie just so we can have a chance to get to the quarterfinals. I mean, the days of Claudio Reyna and Pab Ramos, those days are long gone, and I'm not sure they'll be able to get
yeah.
them back the way things are continuing. So, but
O2 World Cup, man, which is a
yeah.
huge missed opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
Marcus
agreed.
Beasley, Donovan,
yep. Yep.
Just Clint Mathis, you know, just all
yep.
you know, just threw it all away. You know,
yep.
So yeah.
Yep. Well, let's see. Will, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Hey, Will, how you doing?
I'm doing all right. How are you?
Doing all right. Glad you came on. So we were talking about kind of U.S.'s Nations League fiasco and what's going on with all that, and I'd love to hear your take about if you know what's going on with England right now after having a relatively shock defeat to Czech Republic 2-1 to come back and basically wipe the floor with Bulgaria, and in light of some, of course, expected not-so-savory chants from the fans, England seems to have bounced back well from that loss, and of course the press is going to focus on the negative aspects of it, but did you happen to have anything to add about what's going on over in England with their upcoming Euro?
Well, I mean, this has been a pretty standard international break for England, especially in their current group for the qualification, which is Group A.
Mm-hmm.
thought you've got some some heavy hitters in there like Montenegro and Kosovo. you know, it's been a pretty standard international break. You know, England did lose its first match, which is always going to be, you know, oh, is England wobbling? You know, they lost to the Czech Republic, which is always going to be the second team in that group to go through.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they lost their first match six games in.
Right.
You know, my biggest question about England is why Southgate hasn't been a little bit more imaginative with his selections for the team. You know, Trent Alexander-Arnold has been left out. Joe Gomez has been left out. You know, Fikayo Tomori has been left out. Tammy Abraham has been left out. And these are young English players that everyone in the Premier League, at least, seems to think everyone seems to think that they're what the hope of England rests on in the Premier League. And, you know, everyone says, oh, they don't get played because they don't have international experience, but they don't have international experience because they don't get played in the qualifiers.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought this would be a great opportunity for Southgate to, say, put in these young players and give mm-hmm. them some minutes. Because you saw England absolutely destroyed Bulgaria 6-0.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it didn't look as though any player on the field would have missed the chances that England made.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You know, the middle four goals were just shocking defense from Bulgaria.
Yeah. I mean Bulgaria is definitely not the Bulgaria of the, you know, the Hristo Stoichkov era, of the 90s. I mean, Bulgaria is not even a shell of what that team used to be on an international stage. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it seems like the only way they can make headlines is to make monkey chants at black players, and even then, I think I'm like, if there's any country that where you can just blow it off and go, dude, screw you guys. I think this is the situation. They couldn't even get half the people to even come to the game. So I find it quite humorous that UEFA is going to block out 5,000 seats when I was like, there's only 5,000 people there. I mean, this was the game. It's kind of like what I was saying earlier, what Matt and I were talking about earlier, how the Cuba game, we were thinking that the U.S. had an opportunity to not play guys like Michael Bradley and to play, you know, you should have an average age of 19 out there, you know, just play all the kids. It's like, this is a nothing game. And, have that be more of your chance to play the players that a lot of us American fans are seeing that go, these guys need minutes right now because this is a team of the future. This is a team that you hope can compete beyond the weakness that is the CONCACAF outside of Mexico. So I totally agree with you with what England's doing. But what do you see as because, you know, this is, as you said, it's a very common international break for England. Is there anything really positive that could come from this particular international break for England?
I mean, you know, it's sort of one of those breaks that you get to and you think, oh, it's happened again. I guess the nicest thing was, you know, some of the front three in the Bulgaria game all scored. You know, you got Rashford scoring what looked like a cross, and then you got Sterling and Kane scoring along with Barkley. I mean, that's just got to feed those three players confidence because Rashford and Kane, at least, have not had the best, best couple months. So it must be nice for them to score for England. But, I mean, you know, it's what? We're in the... we're in the qualifiers, and we're leading the group, and we've got a pretty solid hold on a spot in the Euros. I don't think it was ever in doubt.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I think that even the players, well, I can't say what the players think, but I think the fans just sort of look at this as, you know, it's happened again.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we've had 2 weeks off, now let's get back to the leagues. And
I have a question for you.
Yeah.
So I noticed that Southgate has kind of gone away from his traditional three at the back, you know, five in the midfield and two up top. Like, what is, you know, do you know anything about that or why that switch? I mean, I feel like that was working for you guys. And I mean, especially with suit players like TAA and, you know, especially like some of those, it would get some of those like center backs in, like Tomori, like you were saying. And then, I mean, I don't know, just England's midfield just looks absolutely atrocious. I mean, it looked terrible against the Czech Republic. Henderson was terrible. Rice was terrible. So it looks like they need some depth in there. So any thoughts on that at all?
Well, I think that going away from a three at the back with the wing backs, it can definitely weaken up the midfield, because the wing backs supported the midfield when you had, you know, the three at the back. But I don't quite, you know, England's midfield, it's sort of a some days it's incredible and some days it's terrible. I think that there are the players for England to have a good midfield, and I think that Henderson can be a good leader in that midfield, as he has been for Liverpool, but, you know, there are some times that you sort of look at the midfield and you think, what? For example, the Czech Republic's first goal, Declan Rice just got absolutely brushed off, and and their centre back scored for basically a free header, and that was supposed to be him picking that up. And then, as you said, it was a very loose midfield. So, you know, I can't say why they moved away from the three at the back, especially with the fullbacks that they've got. Apart from the fact that Southgate does not like to play Trent Alexander-Arnold for whatever reason.
Yeah.
I can't explain that, but, you know, I'm sure he has a strategy. He's done extremely well with this England team, so I'm sure he's got a strategy. I don't know what it is, but he's definitely got a strategy.
So what are we looking at then for, I mean, the 2016 Euro was, I think Ian Dark had probably the greatest 10 minutes of commentating I have ever heard from a live broadcast, when he was just railing during that Iceland game. And I was sitting at our sponsor, Atlantic and Sarper Fiddle, and I was holding my sides from laughter and trying my best not to, because, of course, there was a very pro-England crowd. And as I looked around, I saw I wasn't the only one who found what he was saying extraordinarily humorous. What do you see as a possibility moving forward? Do you think they've improved on that? Are they in a situation where they can have a showing like they did in the World Cup and can potentially, you know, have a run like they did back in 1990 or something like that? What do you, or 92, 91, whatever the year that was. What do you think about England moving forward? Because, you know, they're playing against Kosovo and Montenegro. So, I mean, they're set.
Yeah, I mean, I think that losing to Iceland in 2016 was a low point for England. I think it's that English football has bounced back since then, and bounced back pretty well. You know, they had a pretty, I'm not going to say easy run in the World Cup, but they didn't have the toughest run in the World Cup. And then they went on to the Nations League, and they did pretty well in the Nations League, and they looked to be improving throughout the Nations League. They came third, like they did in the World. They came third in the World Cup, third in the Nations League, and fourth in the World Cup. Whatever, you know, that third place game is kind of irrelevant.
Yeah.
But they made the semifinals in both, and I think that moving forward, the players, at least the players in England, expect more from themselves. They expect to be finishing higher up than they are. I think that's the general feeling of English football. You know, teams in England are getting better each year, and that was pushed forward by Manchester City, that was pushed forward by Liverpool, that was pushed forward by Tottenham in the last few years. And they expect to be going further than they have done in the past, and I think that the feeling from the league really influences the feeling in the national team, because these are the players, the players in the league are the players that make up the squad of England, and they push the team forward. And I don't think that any of the players will be satisfied coming fourth in the Euros. I think that they will expect to make the finals, and even if they don't perform in the finals, I think that they can push for it. But that's just, you know, that's wishful English thinking, isn't it?
Yeah.
Because, you know, all right, like Liverpool, cool. this is England's year, right?
Right, of course.
Yeah.
Well, I'm glad you said like Liverpool, because that gives us a good segue. Before we kind of switch gears here to Premier League, I just want to give another shout out to our sponsor, Flanagan's Harp and Fiddle at 4844 Cordell Avenue, DC, Maryland, Montgomery County's premier location for live sports and music. If you are in the area and you want to come by and have a pint, please do so. Tell them the Two Guys Soccer Podcast sent you. They'd love to have you there. It's also a great atmosphere, good people. You see us there often, especially me on Fridays, and so hopefully you will come by. As I said before, they're showing the Rugby World Cup, and so if you want to get up particularly early and have a nice bowl of oatmeal, which I often call Guinness, feel free to roll over there and have a good time. So we have a return to what us soccer fans actually prefer, and that is of league play. I can say that for when I was, say, back in the mid-90s, when I was much younger, and the only soccer exposure we had was national team games, and that was where I got my soccer fix for such a long time. And I found that once Fox Soccer Channel came on, and then Fox acquired the rights to the Premier League, and then we saw NBC's doing with the Premier League, I can honestly say that my interest in watching international soccer has waned significantly outside of the major tournaments, and I thank you for that. So this weekend coming up, we have a relatively, I don't want to say boring weekend, but I'd say the number of compelling games as it affects the league standings are pretty low. But we do have on Sunday, October 20th, which I'm sure the Premier League expected to be a much more compelling and let's say game than it turns out to be, we have Manchester United versus Liverpool. So we have Man United, who seems to be in the ultimate rebuild, and we see the coaches, Ole Gunnar, saying just believe and buy in and believe and buy in, and not sure how Manchester United fans, how good you are at that. Then we also have Liverpool, who has yet to lose a game, even when they've tried tremendously to do so. So let's talk about this going forward, Manchester United and Liverpool. What do we see here, boys? Let's start with the Manchester United fan. Mike, kick it in. Oh, Mike's not here. I'm sorry. Matt, you're subbing for Mike. Go ahead and kick it in.
Man, big game for us. I don't know. I get some funny feelings with it. Obviously, I'm going to be super pessimistic because that's all this season has shown me so far. So, but there's just one of the. I mean, there's so many storylines there. It might seem really boring to, you know, an Arsenal fan or whatever. But you know, if United lose there, they could quite possibly be in the relegation zone, which would just drive Liverpool fans so happy and mad. But at the same time, you know, I didn't have a chance to kind of end this run for Liverpool that they've been on. They've been on an incredible run right now. And I think if Liverpool wins this weekend, I think they either tie or they break the record that City broke for an unbeaten run to start this season.
I think it's the consecutive wins, yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, I mean, the onus is on United. I think it's at United. It is. And
yep.
I don't know, man. Hopefully Martial's back. We have a lot of players on injury that will hopefully come back. Hopefully Shaw's coming back. I don't know about Pogba. There's been a lot of Instagram videos of him in like Dubai with like almost like a super thick wrap or almost like a cast on his foot. So he might be out, and our midfield is already abysmal. So we'll see how that goes. There was a great article by Michael Cox in The Athletic, I think it was today, talking about how United, you know, XG stats, like expected goal stats and expected goals against stats are actually really,
like they're actually kind of high, and so it kind of examined like why that is, and like it kind of showed like how actually United is, like why are they still playing bad despite the numbers, you know, showing that, and just like kind of terrible conversions and just like their overall style of play is just not clicking. So, you know, luckily for United, they kind of have, they don't have as many people going on the international breaks at the moment because, you know, they're not playing that well. They have Rashford and Maguire, but that's really it. So hopefully they're, you know, all gathered together and trying to find something. I keep bringing it up too. I mean, Chelsea was actually really struggling before the first international break, and when they came back, you know, they were really, really clicking. So hopefully that's the case for us, you know, coming into this weekend. So it'd be a great, great way to turn things, or start to turn things around if we can get this win.
All right, Will, ball's in your court.
Well, you know, I would love to play the cocky Liverpool fan that, you know, we're going to absolutely destroy United. They've had a terrible season. I'd love to play that, but, you know, it's the derby. And you've seen it year after year. Both teams raised their game for this. Last season, we went to Manchester United. We went to Old Trafford. And they put up a stalwart defense. They played an absolutely atrociously boring game of football. But they held us to a draw. And that was one of the games that derailed our title race last year. And I could see them doing that again because, you know, as was mentioned earlier, they haven't had an absolutely atrocious season at the back. They've just not, they're just not scoring that much. And, you know, they've put their hopes in a young English striker. And so, I'm gonna say that Liverpool are definitely the favourites going into this game. Liverpool has a team that, even when it's not firing on all cylinders, is just capable of winning games now. You saw that in the Leicester game, and I don't care what people say, it was a penalty.
That
VAR
was a penalty.
Reviewed it.
That was a penalty. Yeah, it was.
You know, they're capable of winning games, and they're capable of pushing forward, and they're capable of winning. But, you know, Manchester United, they're always a scary fixture for Liverpool fans, because if you, it's sort of, if you lose this game, it sets a tone for the next few weeks. And especially going in with this being the, you know, you win this game and you equal the record for City. It's not a race, Liverpool versus City, but if we don't win this game, it will feel like a defeat, no matter what. And that sets a tone for the next few set of games. And Liverpool coming back from international breaks, sometimes they're weaker, I will say it. Like, it's one of the times that Liverpool has traditionally struggled against other clubs. So this is a very big game for all Liverpool fans and the entire club for Liverpool. I would, at least personally, I would think that.
All right, so I'm putting you both in a spot. I want a score and a result. Start with you, Matt. What you got?
Just because it's home, and I think it's a big game, and exactly kind of what Will says, I mean, it doesn't matter where we're on the table. We have the opportunity right now to kind of derail things a little bit for Liverpool, at least mentally. So I'm going to go 2-1 United.
All right, Will.
I'm just going to say it. I think Liverpool manages to win. I think it's going to be 3-1. I think it's going to be 1-1 at halftime, 3-1 at the end.
Yeah, I'm actually going to go 4-0 Liverpool. I think Manchester United is in a complete free fall right now, and I don't really see how – I mean, I just don't see how they're going to be able to compete in this game. I think, Matt, everything you were saying about Manchester United is extraordinarily true, and every way they could possibly win this game, it's centered around them just being Manchester United. And we've seen that luster of Manchester United – I'm not going to say it's worn off because that would be idiotic. It's just not there right now. And I think moving forward, Manchester United will eventually bounce back. They're Manchester United, but I don't see it happening this season. They're not going to get relegated or anything like that, but they're also not qualifying for Europe. And I just think that if they were, because they are playing a European schedule, which is not that's just going to add more to their plate, and they're just struggling right now, and it's okay.
Yeah.
And I think I give it a couple of years, Manchester United. I have no reason to believe that you all won't be back in full effect. I just don't see it happening. We're 8 games into the season, and you're already starting to see. Yeah. This is usually when you can tell what's going to happen. You know who the top 6 are going to be. You're just not sure of the order. You know who mid-table is going to be. You're just not sure of the order. And you know who's going to be battling for relegation. So, I mean, I think Manchester United's best hope is to finish 8th this season. And the only team that really, to me, that seems to make no sense as far as the way they are with the table is Arsenal. Because the way Arsenal's playing, they shouldn't be in 3rd place. But for some reason, they're in 3rd place. So who knows what's going to happen there. But I think that's the only team that I really have huge question marks about. So, yeah, that was very interesting. I would like to get your take, though, both of you, on Everton. Now, Matt, you weren't quite affiliated with the show just yet, but Will, you were, and we were discussing earlier in the season about how the teams that we suspected that would be struggling and the teams who had the best transfer market. And consistently with the guests we've had on the show, Everton has been a team who we felt had the best transfer market, Everton or Tottenham Hotspur. And because Tottenham, everybody they said they wanted, they particularly got. So, but Everton they really made some great, great, great moves in the offseason. And they are now in 18th place with 2 wins, 1 draw, and 5 losses. And they have sitting on 7 points. So, as I'm going to start with you, Will, since they are 4 miles away from Anfield. What do you think is going on over there at Everton?
I mean, you know, Everton over the last few years has been the king of spending over £100 million and doing absolutely nothing with it. You know, I know from personal experience as a Liverpool fan, you can spend a lot of money in the transfer market and get absolutely nothing. You saw Brendan Rodgers spend over £100 million after Luis Suarez left, and then it was just an atrocious season. I think we scored maybe 40 goals that season. And, you know, just because you spend money doesn't mean that you're going to have a good season. You don't have a good squad yet. And I think that's what Klopp brought to Liverpool. He brought a squad. And I think that Guardiola at Manchester City knows how to spend money and then make a squad. I don't think that Everton knows how to spend money and make a squad. So I think that's basically what's happened for the last few years for Everton.
Yeah. But, you know, you look at their squad, though, and, like, let me just read some names and tell me if this doesn't say talent to you. Richarlison, Gylfi Sigurdsson, you know, Yerry Mina, Cenk Tosun, Morgan Schneiderlin, Andre Gomez, Martin Stecklenburg. I mean, Martin Stecklenburg's a little older, but he's a talented player. Moise Keane. And then you look at some players that are a little older but also have a lot of Premier League experience. You have Theo Walcott, who's had some great Premier League seasons. You have Alex Iwobi. You have England's starting goalkeeper with Jordan Pickford. Leighton Baines has been a very, very consistent defender for a very, very long time. There's no reason that this team should be in 18th place. So would you say this is more of a managerial issue or a tactical issue? Like, what do you think about that? Matt, if you want to jump in, go right ahead.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's exactly what Will is talking about. It's just I feel like they're just buying parts, and they're just not buying. It's like if you have I like to compare it to a car. It's like, you know, if they're a GTI, they're a GTI. You have to buy parts for a GTI. You can't buy like a Ferrari parts, right? I mean, like they're arguably, I think their best and most consistent player is Seamus Coleman, and they bought him for like £300,000, you know, pounds, like from the League of Ireland, like. And he had a full leg break, and he's still like their most consistent player. Because it's just, Everton to me, when I was growing up and watching them, and in the mid-90s, like, it was like they were just a scrappy, like, fighting team. I mean, you think that's how David – I mean, that's what David Moyes built his resume. Like, you know, scrapping out these wins, these scrappy, you know, hard-working teams. And it's like I feel – you know, they bought Richarlison, they bought Yerry Mina, who was like, you know, Yerry Mina was, you know, playing for Barcelona but not starting, and, like, there were all these issues with him. They just, I mean, they were looking at buying Marcus Rojo. I mean, it's, I feel like they want to splash cash, but they just don't have a vision. You know, like, it pains me to say this about Liverpool, but you know, Klopp came in, and look at, you know, a lot of United fans are even saying, you know, it's like, look at the team that when Klopp had them and look at them now. It's like, if you look at that lineup, you know, like, way more than half that team is gone because you realize, like, you know, this is just a bunch of parts that just don't fit my team. And it doesn't, I don't think it matters who the manager is. It's just, you know, from a development perspective, they just really don't ever really buy for the future. It's more like, all right, like, you know, you guys are good, you know, just let's start getting it to click. And I don't think they have it there. And I don't think they will until, you know, they have a big overhaul. So.
Mm. Well, what do you think?
I mean,
yeah.
I'd say that they lack a manager with vision, much like was just stated. Mm-hmm. You know, they have good players, but they don't have a team, and they need a team to improve. So I don't know what that will take for them, but they've got England starting centre back Michael Keane. They've got England starting goalkeeper Jordan Pickford.
Mm-hmm.
And we were talking about how good England is expected to be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, you know, these players can play together, but they need to be managed in a way. So I would say that it is down to the manager, because I don't think that Marco Silva has put this team in a position where it can win and expect to win.
Mm-hmm. Well, all right. Okay, that's then. I'm going to talk about just one more team before we start to wrap up here, because I'm looking through the standings and I'm seeing, okay, what are the surprise teams so far this season. And, you know, you're looking at Burnley, who's in seventh, but Burnley's been up. They've been up there before. This isn't necessarily too out of the ordinary for them. You're looking at Sheffield, who's, you know, won a couple of games, and they're fun to watch. But, you know, they're still only on 9 points. But a team that's been the most surprising is a team that I picked to be relegated, and that's Crystal Palace, who's sitting on 14 points. And this is also a team that looked like they were going to implode right before the season started due to the issues of player transfers. And you saw their best player, who I can't sit here and say that I think he's as good as maybe most think he is, but, you know, Wilfred Zaha made it no secret he was trying to get out, and he talked about his boyhood love for Arsenal. Who knows how true all that really is? And now he's playing for Crystal Palace, and he's having a pretty good season. So he seems more of a disruptor than anything else, because he, for someone who's listed as a forward, he doesn't score. He hasn't scored a Premier League goal yet this year, and it's not like Crystal Palace is lighting up the scorers table either, as they've only scored 8 goals this year. I mean, you never see a team sitting in sixth place with a goal differential of 0. But what's in the Kool-Aid over there? Why is Crystal Palace able to survive as well as they've been? What do you think about this? Let's start with you, Will.
Well, I mean, Crystal Palace is just sort of, I mean, I'm looking at their results, and they just sort of grind out results to get them points. You know, I believe, like, they have no games that are absolutely outstanding. They did just win a London derby against West Ham.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Jordan Ayew, someone who you haven't talked about in, I don't know, 10 years, is scoring goals for them. They have a solid team and a solid penalty taker in Mihailovic. And, you know, Zaha might not score goals, but I'm certain that he will win penalties.
Mm-hmm.
And if you have someone who can put those away, you get a goal in the game. And then if you score a goal and you have a pretty solid defense like they have, then you're on track to winning. And it's pretty much as simple as that. They had, I think their most famous result this season will definitely be Manchester United on the first day,
mm-hmm.
where Dan James goes to celebrate in the 89th minute, and then that gets cut short a few minutes later. I still remember that, and I still quite like that memory.
I mean, some of the magic of Roy Hodgson, isn't it? I mean, Jesus, guy just grinding out results from a team. I mean, this team just is not like. I mean, you look at the players, and I mean, it's almost the exact opposite of what we're talking about with Everton, isn't it? Like, I mean, it's like, yeah. I mean, the sum of its parts probably, you know, talent-wise, doesn't even come close to what Everton has. But at the same time, they're playing as a unit. They're playing as a team. I mean, a lot of people are loving. Norwich right now, they're kind of struggling, but to start off the season, everyone was going crazy about Pookie, and the team was playing well in the game. I remember them giving Chelsea a really close game, and it was like a 3-2 game. But Crystal Palace has just found ways to get results, and I'm sure if you look at the stats and the advanced statistics, I'm sure they're going to come crashing back down. But it is kind of good to see that they're grinding at the results if they're playing well early. Let's see how they get around Christmas period when, the league matches are coming thick and fast. But it is a good story to see. Unfortunately, we're one of the reasons why they're up so high because they, they beat us. All power to them. Honestly, as the United fan too, the fact that they're doing pretty well, makes you feel a little bit better. They hadn't won until they beat us, but they've gone on kind of a run. The last, few results are two wins, a draw, and yeah, they have a loss, but they're still 1-3 the last five games. So, they're doing what they have to do to, pick up points. And right now it's vital. Like, all points for them are vital. So, good for them.
I mean, another point about Palace is their next scheduled game is Manchester City. The game after that is against Arsenal. The game after that is against Leicester City, a team that's doing absolutely incredibly under the trainer Brendan Rodgers. And then they're playing Chelsea. And then they're playing Liverpool. So we
should have the same conversation again in about a month. Let's talk again in a month, and then we'll see what's going on.
If we talk
Palace.
Again in a month, I think that Palace
does play really well against Liverpool, though. So you gotta give them that. But yeah, we'll see. I mean, they're... And that's what I'm saying. Like, I'm sure down the line, they're going to come back to earth. I don't like to plug advanced stats too much, but I'm sure it's like when you're looking at expected goals or whatever, or just how they're playing against teams, they're grinding them out right now. But when it comes to the better teams, they're probably going to start.
Yeah.
I mean, they did lose the first 4-0. So they definitely have that in them as well. So.
Yeah, I mean, as much as we like to see Crystal Palace sitting in sixth and then laughing at Manchester United sitting in 12th, with Zaha above the team that he was heavily linked to, I do believe that they have a tough run of the schedule coming up.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, well, Matt, I'm going to let you go because Will and I are going to shift gears here. We're going to discuss a little bit of the Track and Field World Championships before we sign off. But, again, thank you so much for coming on. And thanks for coming on early and pinch hitting for a bit.
Absolutely.
And thanks for the 3-week one you've been on. It's really been great hearing your perspective about especially the development of U.S. soccer and youth development and talking about MLS. So we have the MLS playoffs starting this weekend, so I'm sure next week we're going to spend a lot of time talking about that. So hopefully we'll catch up
Sounds
with
great.
You soon, and we'll get up with Mike, and then we'll get you back on the show real soon.
Sounds great. Yeah, thanks for having me
All
on,
right.
and Will, great talking to you as well.
Great talking to you.
All right, Will. Let's see. I was waiting to talk about this. I was like, do I just steal a minute from Mike and I hope, I don't know what's didn't get Mike on tonight. Hopefully he's all right. But I can't see a better time than now to discuss the recently concluded 2019 World Track and Field Championships. So let me just ask you just flat out, what do you think was a performance that particularly stood out to you?
That's a difficult one.
Yeah.
the performance that stood out to me the most, you know, I'm going to say it because I'm always partial to a good 800 runner.
Mm-hmm.
I think that Donovan Brazier, 142, was probably the one, mostly because, you know, he's my age and he runs my event. And he broke the American record.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think he's going to. I don't think he's going to take my all-time heroes, David Dudisha's record. But I think that he's a very exciting, very young runner coming through the American track and field system.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's probably my most exciting runner.
Yeah. I have to agree from that perspective of just what was the race that I thought was a real shot for the U.S. to kind of come back to an event that they had dominated in the past. And Donovan Brazier coming out, but also getting three Americans in that final, I thought was huge. That was really huge. But, I can't pick out a particular performance outside of that was really exciting to me, but I talk about this a lot with people who are track people, but it's just the continued domination of runners from Kenya and Ethiopia in the middle and distance events. I mean, you're looking at the medal winners from 800 meters through the marathon, and 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 of them are from Kenya or Ethiopia. And this has been going on for decades now, and I can't see this ever. I don't know when this is going to end, because even when you're seeing runners who seem – I think the last World Championships, you saw runners from, like, Qatar and Turkey and stuff like that, but they were all of Kenyan or Ethiopian descent, and I don't want to sound like they're of descent where their parents are, like they're immigrants. No, they were from and they trained in those countries, and they just happened to represent Qatar or a nation like Turkey. So The athletes that they're churning out over there that are just specially built for these events is just shocking. And on top of that, to have what happened with – I'm sure you saw what happened with Eliud Kipchoge's marathon and going sub two – even with pacers and everything like that, but going sub 2 hours and running an average of 4:33 per mile 26 times is something that I just don't think – I don't think we've ever seen dominance like this in track. Because I can also include the first and second place runners in the 3,000 meter steeplechase for the men is just really special. And you could even include that with the women, because they were also very dominant in the 1500 on through the marathon. So, I mean, what do you see that? Cause like, I remember when they weren't the best, you know, and so I'm a little bit older, but you know, have you seen this your whole life? What's this been like for you to watch?
Well, first of all, I'm glad you brought up Kipchoge's marathon and the fact that, you know, he had paces. I think that it's kind of bullshit that it's not considered an official world record. Roger Bannister had paces. He had a very similar pacing system when he broke 4. And I think that, you know,
Hisham El-Garoush had paces as well for his mile record.
I think it's just, you know, I don't know what to call it. I think it's just he did it. He ran a sub 2 hour marathon, which everyone has always said is going to be the impossible thing for humans to do. And then he broke it by 20 seconds. I don't care if he had paces. I don't care if people were breaking the wind for him. He ran 26.2 miles in under 2 hours.
Agreed.
And he doesn't deserve an asterisk next to his record.
I agree completely, because it's almost impossible to break these world records in these distance races without pacers. It doesn't happen very much. That's why you rarely see these types of races, these world records set at Olympic events. They're always set at like a meet setup where they have runners who they pay handsomely to just act as a rabbit, and your job is to go out and push the pace. It happens race after race after race. I don't know why this would be any different. I couldn't agree with you more.
I mean, you can see that the runners don't care that he's the one that got – he had the best distance runners on earth pacing him for this.
Pacing him.
The runners
don't
care.
No, they were excited for him.
It's someone above the runners who cares and is willing to take this away, and he doesn't deserve to have – this asterisk next to his incredible record.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, going back to your point about the Kenyans, you know, they have a very, very well set up training system.
Mm-hmm.
I might have been a bit of a massive fan of David Rudisha
mm-hmm.
from 2011 till he basically retired.
Mm-hmm.
So I read into the sort of, you know, training that he did. And they've got just, they've basically got schools set up for runners.
Mm-hmm.
And these runners train in some of the best conditions on Earth in the Great Rift Rally
mm-hmm.
for training, and they're it sounds mean to say it, but they're interchangeable people until they get good.
you say the same thing in Ethiopia. I think their training is a bit more. I don't think it gets quite the attention. Because of the kind of the love affair we've had with the Kenyan runners, but you know, there's so, I mean, as you said, they're interchangeable. There's so many Kenyan runners. They're not as many Ethiopian runners when it comes to the system that they work. But Ethiopia has been, I don't want to say equally as dominant, but as close to equally as dominant as you could be. And this World Championship proved it with the way they were able to compete. Now, granted, I don't think Kenya sent all their best runners to this World Championships as well, primarily probably because of the conditions they were going to be running in, with it being, you know, the marathon had to start at midnight and it was still 97 degrees outside. So, but yeah, the way they, there's something that they often say about why they're dominant, because we've talked about altitude training and their conditions and everything like that, but yet they've, it's not like we're getting a bunch of Swiss runners who are dominant, you know, who have, I don't want to say similar conditions, but also have the altitude to kind of assist them in their development. But it seems like those runners know how to run when it hurts better than anybody you've ever seen. And, you know, we've both done a multitude of races where you're getting to that last lap and your chest just feels like it's going to explode and you still have 400 meters left to run. And that ability to push through that wall really does set one runner apart from the other. But it's really fascinating to see. I do want to shift gears here, though, and ask you, what did you think of that mixed 4x4 relay that they did, where they had two male and two female runners? Did you catch that? Did you see any of that?
That was the one that the U.S. won, wasn't it?
Yeah, they set some world record. And, you know, I don't know. Yeah, the U.S.
won. I'm always a big fan of relays.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that this is the sort of thing that it seems like I would do with everyone from my high school track team
mm-hmm.
at the end of the meet.
Mm-hmm.
Because I remember there were about eight guys on my high school track team that were really good, and then we'd do a draft for the 4x4 at the end.
Mm-hmm.
And this it gives me the feeling of that, and I think that it's a really good idea.
Mm-hmm.
Because you know it doesn't, you know, these are the two. I mean, Allison Felix was in this, and she is I think what the best. She's got the most
She's got the most medals of anybody in any
ever.
World. No, I think she has the most of anyone who competes in the World Championships. I think she has the most.
Yeah. So you've got some incredible talents coming from both from both sexes, and they're doing a relay, and I think that I fully support it. I like it.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
Yeah.
I can't say anything bad about it.
Yeah, it was, you know, it was fun. It was a little odd to watch at first because I like that they don't give them a lot of rules. It's not like the men have to run against the men and the women have to run against the women. They had, I know for the actual event final, a team from Poland actually ran their two male runners first
and their two female runners second, where basically every other nation ran their they ran male, female, female, male. And so Poland got out to a relatively big lead during the second leg, but you saw, I think it was Allison Felix's leg, she hung pretty good, and he didn't get as far out as he really needed to be. And by the time the anchor leg came around, the Polish runner was passed by four of the male runners, and she was passed by the American runner probably in the first 200 meters. So I think that just was kind of difficult to watch just from a racing standpoint, because you're like, it just looked weird because the way the whole system broke down, it just seemed a little odd. But it was an exciting race to watch, and it's going to be in the next Olympics, which is great. And I'm glad they got it in the World Championships, because this can be something that could be just something fun to watch. I'm also a huge fan of the relays. I'm really happy that the United States finally kind of like put a relay together and didn't drop the baton or fall out of the exchange zone or anything like that. I think the holes in the U.S. Relay system, with the way the runners basically all train separately, really had been exposed, and with their inability to actually compete in the relays. But I'll just throw a shout to the United States for actually winning the 4x1 with your boy anchoring. Let me ask you this one more question. Noah Lyles is going to run the 100 in the Olympics, and it's going to be a Christian Coleman Noah Lyles battle for the 100 meter crown. Do you think Coleman takes this, or is Lyles better?
You know what? I'm gonna say Noah Lyles wins the 100 and the 200 in the Olympics. I believe in the person I raced against in high school.
Yeah.
not only so that I can say that I raced against the Olympic champion, but I genuinely believe that he can do it. I think that, you know, Coleman has had an incredible career. Has had an incredible world championship, but I think that Noah Lyles, I think that he can do it. And if he can't do it this time, he's going to win. He's going to win in 4 years' time.
He's still pretty young, and I think as well. Noah Lyles seems to be a little bit leaner, which sometimes isn't always the best for a sprinter, but he's still. He was the world leader in the 100 up until the final, and he ran quite a – I don't want to say a pedestrian 200 meters, but it seemed like he wasn't even – he didn't need to put his all in for that final to beat Andre de Grasse. So I'm not sure that he will have much competition. I think Justin Gatlin wants to run in the next Olympics. I personally think that he's a risk to not even make the squad. Even as a silver medalist in the World Championships, we'll see what happens in the next year. Because a year is a long time, especially – it can be a long time in track. So so we'll see what happens. Especially for a 37-year-old. We'll see what happens with that going forward. So, all right. Well, let's go ahead and wrap this up this week. Will, thanks again for coming on. And I'm really glad we got a chance to discuss these World Championships. On a podcast setting. Hopefully we didn't scare off too many of the soccer fans, the five that hopefully listen to this show. All the best to you, and we'll get you back on the show real quick.
Yeah, it's been a good time.
All right, thanks a lot. All right, and we'll just give one final shout to our sponsor at Flanagan's Harp and Fiddle at 4844 Cordell Avenue. Also want to thank producer Paul for keeping the show going, even with my extraordinarily late beginning of the show. Just one piece of advice I can say to everybody is to make sure you periodically check your junk folder in your email, because there may be something quite important in there that you may need. So for the Two Guys Soccer Podcast, one more thing is to, I encourage you all to tune in to the Manchester United Liverpool upcoming game this Sunday at 11:30. That should be a fun one to watch. And also to check out the quarterfinals of the Rugby World Cup if you happen to have a night of insomnia and you're up at 3 o'clock in the morning. Click on the television. That should be pretty entertaining. So for the Two Guys Soccer Podcast. I am Armstead, otherwise known as Stead, and hopefully we did okay this week. We will be sure to do a better job next week. Good night, everybody.